Give the perfect memorable gift. Name a star after someone. For $54 and a call to
806, it's at right now. Yeah, bottom line is that you had an explosive move out there. We're going to be having Goldcorp earnings. They're going to be coming out in a second. They just sent that over. And right now, though, we're going over and we're getting our education of a lifetime from Dr. Edward Vieira Jr., Pieces of Eight, the Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edward, how you doing?
Fine, Tom. How are you?
Great. I really apologize for last Wednesday, man. I just blew it. That's the bottom line.
Oh, no problem. But
listen, let me ask you. I'd like to go back to, you know, folks, each and every Wednesday, Edward's been giving us a great education about the monetary powers and disabilities of our great system and what it has to do with not only how we spend our money every day, but what it has to do with the Constitution. I'd like to go back to March 1933, Roosevelt's first fireside chat. Can you tell the folks about that? Folks, I got to tell you something. You can get the book. If you go to our website at TFNN, go to the contributors page, right? And Edward's bio's right there. It hooks right into his page. This is a phenomenal book. It's two books. It's two volumes. It's 1,600 pages. But I can tell you, if you just want something that is an encyclopedia of just knowledge, it's unbelievable. Anyway, I was going over this Roosevelt. Let's go through this fireside chat, because this is just amazing what actually happened in 1933, I guess.
All right, let's remember what the background here is.
Okay.
You had the crash of the stock market in 1929.
Yes.
And then there was constant turmoil in the markets. The banks, of course, had become overextended during the expansion of the late 1920s. And the banks started to have runs by their depositors. People coming into the banks demanding that the banks would redeem their currency or would pay out their deposits in United States currency, which might have been gold, it might have been gold certificates, it might have been silver coin, whatever. But the banks were all operating on a fractional reserve principle, and therefore they found it extremely hard to respond to those runs. And
yes.
Many of them were closing down. There was essentially banking chaos. By the time you got to the end of 1932, things were in terrifically bad shape. So the question was, what was going to happen when the new administration came into power? Because, of course, the Hoover administration, bore the brunt of the political blame, at least, for what had occurred. And Roosevelt had been elected in a landslide because people were now desperate. You were in the middle of this huge banking crisis, and depression, so forth and so on. That was the economic background. Now, the point that I like to make about this period was that at that time, you probably had a higher level of real literacy in this country than you do today.
Really?
Real literacy.
Wow.
Not simply the sense that people could read and write.
Yes.
But they were reading and writing at a higher level.
Okay.
And if you go back to the turn of the century, for instance, 30 years earlier, and you read the American Federationist newspaper, which was the newspaper of the American Federation of Labor, right? The
yes.
big labor union at that time. We still have it today. It's the AFL-CIO because it merged with the CIO,
okay.
Congress of Industrial Organizations, created in the 1930s. But the AFL was in existence, and it was big. It was powerful. It was the union of the people who were involved essentially in skilled trades. They had a magazine called or a newspaper called the American Federation. Samuel Gompers was the president at that time.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if he remembers his name.
Absolutely.
And if you go back to that turn of the century period, there was tremendous debate then among proponents of a monometallic gold standard, proponents of the free coinage of silver, proponents of paper money, proponents of central banking. And you find that that newspaper was full of discussion about those subjects.
Wow.
And really at a very high level of understanding.
Right.
Now, those people who read that magazine were primarily skilled workers. They were carpenters, they were plumbers, and so forth and so on. They were what we would call today blue-collar workers.
Yes.
But in their own newspaper, their own organization, they were debating these issues of monetary policy, which, of course, you see no one debating today,
no.
right?
No.
The average worker was debating that in 1900. By the time you got to 1933... you still had that level of education. At least that's my impression from what I've read in that
sure.
Over that period. Roosevelt becomes president, and his first act was to close the banks. the so-called bank holiday.
Yes.
And the purpose of this was so that the banks would no longer have to pay out their deposits or redeem currency and give them an opportunity to give the fractional reserve system something of a breathing spell and try to save as many banks as he could save. He comes on radio in his first so-called fireside chat, nationwide radio, and he gives the American people an explanation of what he's doing. And he says essentially, listen, you have to understand how the banking system really works. When you put your money in there, it's not just in a box in the back room. They've taken that and they've loaned it out. He's explaining the fractional reserve system to people.
Right.
The money isn't there, the banks can't get it immediately, and we have to have this period of respite, if you will, this period of leaving the banks so they don't have to fulfill their contractual obligations.
Yeah, they change the rules, right.
They change the rules in order to try and salvage the system. Now, what makes that point in history fascinating to me is, given the high level of literacy of people in the country, given the fact that 30 years earlier, in reading of the American Federation's 1900, I've done a lot of that, the average worker, union member, was aware of all of these issues of money and banking, and actually was against, the average worker in those days was against central banking, and he was in favor of gold and silver, in favor of hard money.
Right.
Because the union movement realized at that time, which they don't today, but they realized at that time, that hard money was a safeguard for the average worker. In any event, here was this, in this 30-year period, the level of understanding had gone down sufficiently so that the President of the United States felt that he had to go on nationwide radio in an unprecedented address and explain to people how the banks worked.
Yeah, well, you know, it's incredible, and that's why I'm glad we're getting into it today. We're in the same situation today. I mean, you know, fractional banking, folks, just a quick one, you know, a bank can take 10 cents and loan out a dollar. So that's why you can't get your money if you walk into the bank and ask them for all your money. That's what it comes down to. But
if enough people do it.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. They operate in a kind of Ponzi scheme, and as long as they keep getting those deposits in from others, they'll be able to pay out to the certain number of people who actually come in and request return.
Yes.
But once there's sufficient demand, as in a crisis, see, that's the interesting thing about that system. That system is always crisis-prone. You don't care about its stability when there's no crisis, right?
Right.
I don't care about the fact that the brakes on my car work well or ill when it's parked in the garage. I want to know whether those brakes are going to work well when I'm doing 70 miles an hour on the interstate.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And that's the problem with our banking system. Oh, yes, when there's no crisis, when there's no strain on the system, it works fine. As soon as there's a crisis, the thing has a tendency to collapse. You see, it's exactly the inverse of the way an intelligent person would devise a financial system. You want to be sure that a financial system is going to stay together, not in the good times, but in the hard times. Whereas the fractional reserve system, being basically a Ponzi scheme, has this inherent instability built into it.
And
here's Roosevelt coming on in March of 1933, explaining to the average American how the system worked and why the average American couldn't get his money out of the bank. You look at the situation today. The average person today certainly does not understand as much about economics as the average person probably did in the 1930s.
Yes.
The average working man, at least if it's reflected in what I've read in union newspapers or what you hear union leaders saying, those people know a lot less than they knew in the past. You don't find someone with the knowledge of Samuel Gompers leading any of the big unions today.
No, you don't. And what you don't have, and this is crucial, folks, in each and every one of your communities, you want to open up these topics. You have to get into the real topic, and the real topic is what is quality of wealth, what is the quality of the dollar? What are we talking about? What are you going out every single day for working and being on, you know, this mill? You know, because you're on a mill, and we're all on it, and we get out there, and we run every single day. Well, what do we want it for? And, you know, it's a great place to start. You know what's amazing, Edward, is that when I'm reading this, that it seems like nothing ever changes. Roosevelt, in fact, not only did that, but then he blames the public for doing it instead of, you know, when you look at the fact of the matter, It's basically how the system is set up.
That's right. It's amazing because when someone went to the bank to withdraw his deposits or to ask for redemption of the bank's notes in United States coinage, what was he doing? He was simply asking the bank to fulfill the contractual promises the bank had made.
Exactly.
That's what's fascinating about that whole era and the whole subject of fractional reserve banking, that the banks are always standing up and the politicians behind them are always standing up and blaming people who are trying to hold the financial system to the promises that it made.
Right.
It's fascinating. Right. Now, what interests me even more than this is, because if you look today in the schools,
yes,
let's say high schools, for instance, because not everyone goes on to colleges, but basically in high school, what are they taught about the economic structure of this country and how it actually functions? Very, very little, and most of it is propaganda.
Yep.
Yet, one who has looked into this the way you have, and all of your listeners, I'm sure, understand that in a market economy where everything is exchanged through a price structure, the reason we know that some things are more valuable than others is what? One has a higher price than the other.
Yep.
And all of those prices are expressed in what? Monetary units, right? So money is at the very foundation of our entire economic system, and to the extent that the rest of our society is built on that economic system, money is probably the key component of everything. And yet we have left that key component in the hands of one particular special interest group,
yep,
the banking community,
right,
and the political class. And if you take a look at the political class, almost anywhere in this country, you have to ask the question, how could any American in his right mind leave his entire economic future, the economic future of his family, in the hands of people who are, to a very large degree, egocentric and concerned only with their own careers? Right? Après moi le déluge, as the French used to say, right?
Exactly.
After I'm gone, who cares what happens?
And that's where there's no two ways about that. You know what's amazing, too? And folks, you know, we've talked about it before, it's the dumbing down of America. I mean, for years, I've really thought that, well, it's hard to say there's a conspiracy behind it, because it's almost like, you know, each and every, you know, group and subgroup, it just seems that they, each and every year, it gets worse and worse. You know what is amazing, though, in the money is one thing, but the social studies, you know, how many times do you study the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence? I mean, they've taken that out of some of the schools. I mean, that absolutely blows my mind. I was talking to a teacher, and I said, you know, I felt so lucky that my son and my daughter, my son in particular, he had this one teacher. Oh, my God, it was one of the best classes I ever seen in my life. It was a seventh grade, and it was social studies. Oh, it was, and he brought the parents in at night. It was unbelievable. But you don't see that. You just don't see. They don't teach children their rights.
You know one of the reasons for that, I think, and let's go at the high school level.
Yes.
Because I have actually had a lot of interaction with people at that level. If you lay the Constitution down in front of someone and simply go through it systematically, it is not an obscure document.
No, it's not.
It's not that difficult to understand. You don't have to have a graduate degree in political science or something to be able to understand it. That was written for New England farmers,
yes,
and Maryland merchants and,
yep,
so forth and so on. They were literate people. They were reasonably educated people. But they weren't graduate students in political science, right?
Right.
The problem, though, is if you read it and then you think about what the system is how the system is actually functioning today, you immediately run into a disparity. Wait a minute. Here's what the Constitution says. This is pretty clear.
Yeah.
And yet here's what Congress is doing, or here's what the Supreme Court is doing, or what have you. And you run immediately into the old phrase, cognitive dissonance, right?
Yeah.
Two things clashing.
Right.
It doesn't work. And then, of course, an intelligent person, reasonably intelligent person, starts asking the question, wait a minute. If the Constitution says X, how can the government be doing Y?
Right.
Right? And you get into all sorts of political problems, which I'm sure is one of the reasons behind the scenes that the establishment in this country does not like that subject to be brooded about.
It's unreal.
They do not want to have that kind of questioning constantly arising for the simple reason they don't have the answer. I mean, I would love to get into a debate. You pick whoever you want.
Yeah.
You know, establishment legal scholars, or bring somebody from the Treasury Department or the Federal Reserve. I would be glad to stand on a platform anywhere in the country and debate these people over what the constitutional monetary powers are.
Right.
Because if you've looked at my book, and I know you have, these things are not obscure.
No, they're clear.
They're clear
as a bell. All right.
But you can be sure that they will never invite me to such a debate.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that's what tells you that's the key to the whole thing. In a so-called democracy, an open society, these issues are always on the table.
Folks, what Edwin just said here, I really want you to understand something, because I'm into this in a big way. It's defensive thinking. You know, Edwin, what you said, and I look at a lot of issues like this, them not wanting you there or ever inviting you, that says more than anything to me. It's like, you know, when I'm trading, if I see something that's not happening, that means more than something that is happening. Isn't it wild?
Right.
But it really is, and that's where
right.
It's unbelievable. Listen, folks, it's Pieces of Eight. It's Edwin Vieira. You go to our website at TFNN. Click on that thing. I got to tell you, folks, it's like $59. You will have a blast with this book. And then what you have to do, folks, is bring it into your community and start it out on a grassroots level. That's the real bottom line.
Right.
Edwin, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Have a great one. And listen, folks, okay, anyone wants a copy of the Constitution out there, what I want you to do, it's a one-time deal just for today. Marvin's going to kill me. Just go Marvin at TFNN. We'll send those Constitutions out. This is Tom O'Brien. We're going to be right back, folks.
Tom O'Brien.
On the S&Ps, on the NASDAQ, 1.8 versus 1.6. We broke the swing from July 2nd with volume. So that says the correction is going to be a little bit bigger. Now, as each and every Wednesday at 4:20, we have our man, Dr. Edwin Vieira, Pieces of Eight, giving us an absolutely phenomenal education on, our monetary system. The book he has, one of the books he has, folks, that we're going through, and you can get this book. All you do is you go to TFNN, go to the contributor page, you'll see the bio in Edwin Vieira. It's Pieces of Eight. It's an absolutely phenomenal book, folks, okay? It's two volumes, approximately 1,687-89 pages. And you want to know, understand the history behind this move. It's absolutely phenomenal. And the key here, folks, going through this, bar none, well, there's a lot of different keys, but the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edward, how you doing?
Oh, fine, Tom. How are you?
Great, man. Great. You know, the last couple of weeks, first we talked about, the Roosevelt, the fireside, chat. We talked about Trading with the Enemy Act. You know what I'd love to get? Well, we could, so that's how gold got, basically illegal in this country, right?
Right.
Now, what brought it back? I know, what brought gold, why did they legislate gold back into it, into the system, when, they have all this fiat money going on?
Let's understand one thing. When Roosevelt seized the gold in 1933 and 34,
yes,
the purpose of that was to protect the banks domestically. That was what they used to call a suspension of specie payment. That allowed the banks to renege on their contracts to redeem currency, and the Treasury also to renege on its agreement to redeem currency or to pay its bonds in gold.
That's right. Change the rules domestically
and forget it. Our creditors are getting what they're getting. You're going to get paper. You're not going to get gold anymore. But internationally, they had to maintain an international gold standard because obviously foreign countries aren't put off as easily as domestic citizens, right?
Yes.
You can't just thumb your nose at some of the major powers in the world and expect to maintain proper trade relations and other kinds of relations. So they continued to have Federal Reserve notes redeemable in gold for foreigners. Now, at that time, that was not a particular strain to the United States, because remember, the depression throughout the world, and of course, the war intervened. The war was actually going on in the 30s with Abyssinia, Ethiopia, and the Spanish Civil War, and all those things that were preludes to World War II. So there was a tremendous amount of instability and fear throughout the world, both in Europe and in Asia, and a lot of gold came into the United States.
Okay.
In fact, there was a tremendous influx of gold into the United States, and we had a huge supply of it, national stockpile of gold, primarily because of the economic conditions, and then on top of those, the conditions of near war or real war when it developed. So you get into the 1950s, and of course the Bretton Woods Agreement 1944 made the Federal Reserve System essentially a world central bank and the Federal Reserve note a world currency. At least it was the leading currency.
And Edward, as that gold was coming in, so in the 30s, when it was instability, basically, at the end of the 30s, I gather what you're saying, is there's instability across the world. Gold is coming to the U.S., and that's what makes, I mean, gold is power, right? And so that's making us much more powerful. Would that be correct?
Well, I would think so, yes. Right, that's okay. Certainly, that was the old mercantilist view, that the more specie you had flowing into the country, the sounder your financial condition, and then you could also look at that in terms of your foreign policy condition. Well, in any event, there we were. In the 1950s, there was this huge stock of gold. Then the Federal Reserve, towards the end of the 50s and certainly through the 60s and the Kennedy-Johnson era, the Federal Reserve embarked on a huge, relative to the times at least, a huge expansionary program. It wouldn't be considered huge today. I mean, today we've gone beyond the words like huge, right?
Right.
In terms of expansion. But it was huge in that period of time. And foreigners were increasingly becoming distrustful of the American monetary system. They had to deal with it because of the Bretton Woods Agreement, but they began to demand more and more redemption of Federal Reserve notes, of deposits in Federal Reserve notes. You see, during the 60s, a huge outflow of gold, essentially about 50% or more of the gold stock of the United States, went somewhere. We don't know where. I've actually seen many or most of those records, and what they generally tend to show is a payment that's made to some foreign central bank. But you know that behind those foreign central banks, there were many other people who were eventually receiving that gold.
So they're sending fiat currency in and getting gold out, right?
Right. We're sending fiat currency out into the world to pay our bills.
Yes.
And these foreigners are becoming distrustful of it, and they are cashing it in through their central banks and demanding redemption from the Federal Reserve. And the U.S. Treasury is, in fact, sending physical gold to these foreign central banks. Well, this lasts only until Richard Nixon. And Nixon, by 1971, Nixon and Connally, John Connally, the man who was, of course, governor of Texas, shot when Kennedy was assassinated. Connally was Secretary of the Treasury, and they began to be worried. I guess people had been worried earlier, but certainly by this point in time, August of 1971, there was a real fear of this run on the gold stock, and Nixon, as the expression went, closed the gold window. He did internationally what Roosevelt had done domestically in 1933 and 34. He said, no more payments of gold. No more payments of gold.
Right. That's unbelievable.
So this is the second bankruptcy. I mean, there was a bankruptcy in 1933-34, and then there was a second bankruptcy in 1971. So people who say that, you know, sound is a dollar, they're living in a dream world. In the last century, there were two bankruptcies right there. That's 1971. Now, the Treasury, of course, subsequently entered into a vendetta or a propaganda war against gold. And we're hearing things about gold being a barbarous relic, gold no longer being relevant, that money could be managed. You hear all that propaganda.
Sure.
And at the same time, there was some lonely voices. I remember Jesse Helms, I think, was one of them, who was attempting to promote the reallowance of Americans to own gold.
Yes.
And that, in fact, happened in 1973. They passed a statute in Congress saying that it was no longer illegal to own gold. And I think that the reason that that went through was because, on the one hand, some of the managed money people really believed their own propaganda. They said, gold is not money anymore.
Right.
We don't redeem paper currency in gold. We don't use it really as reserves, as fictitious reserves for the banking system, but it's not really used in the sense that it was in, say, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. So it's really a relic, and it doesn't make any difference whether people own it. It's not going to have any effect. And then on the other hand, I think that there was a certain line that was probably taken, look, if we don't do this, we're going to create more and more suspicion. We want to make it appear that we don't care.
Yes.
So let's put it in. Let's put it in our territory. Now, the interesting thing, of course, in 1973, yes, you could own gold, but you could not make a gold clause contract. You could not make a contract demanding that you be paid in gold coins. All right?
Okay.
So they had it going both ways. You could own it, but you couldn't use it the way gold had been used as money up until 1933.
Okay.
Well, that comes in 1977. Finally, by 1977, the managed money people are sufficiently convinced that they have befuddled the average American into believing that gold is of no real significance monetarily, that they reallow gold clause contracts as of October of 1977. So that is now the law. We have a provision in Title 31 of the United States Code which says, yes, you can make gold-cost contracts, and of course everyone can own gold, can own silver. So it's perfectly possible today for people to arrange their financial situation, at least if you're not a wage earner, you know, where you can't control what your employer's going to pay you.
Yes.
But if you're an independent entrepreneur, if you're your own businessman, you're professional, and so forth and so on, you have your own business, yes, you can arrange it so that you can take only gold, only silver, or what have you, essentially opt out of the Federal Reserve System. Now, there are a number of complexities that are involved in there. But what do we see? We do not see significant numbers of people doing that.
Right.
Which tells you one of two things. Either that it is so complicated to do it, and there are such costs involved in it, that it isn't economically viable, even though people may believe that gold and silver still have great monetary value and potential.
Yes.
Or, I suppose, the vast mass of people really have bought the propaganda of the managed money fiat crowd that gold and silver are really not money at all.
Absolutely.
They're for jewelry, and they're for putting in your teeth and so forth and so on. They're for industrial use, but they're not money. Now, see, the interesting thing is, this is not a new idea. You know the old saying, nobody learns anything from history except that nobody learns anything from history, right?
I love it.
We were all repeating these eras of the past.
Yes.
It doesn't come out exactly the same way, but that type of situation reoccurs, and we live through it again. Go back to John Law in France.
Oh, yeah.
The early 1700s in France. He created the Bank of France. This guy was the major financial power in France. He was given all sorts of special privileges by the French court. And paper money was one of the things that he foisted on France. And again, it was one of those ideas that this is much more modern, much more scientific than gold and silver. Well, it was a disaster, a huge disaster. And it was probably one of the major, precursors that led to the French Revolution and the destruction of the old French monarchic system.
Yeah,
right?
The amount of money lost there was phenomenal.
It was phenomenal. It's huge. It bankrupted the French government. It bankrupted the nobility. I mean, it was a terror. It was a wipeout of the financial system at almost every level. But there you go. That same idea was there. We heard it during the Roosevelt era. It didn't work during the Roosevelt era. We're hearing it today, not only in the United States, but they're talking about this, of course, on the international level because they want to have a world currency.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
They want to take this to the international level. That same fallacy is there. We are just waiting now for the, as it were, the other shoe of history to drop to show us how that fallacy works itself out in real life.
You know what's amazing? And folks, just, you know, check this out because, you know, I love how you set these up, Edmund, too. You know, when you look at 1933, one bankruptcy. And that first bankruptcy, folks, okay, flat out is that the banks would no longer, you know, give you gold for your dollar bills. The second one, in 1971, same deal. That's an international level, right? Now we're dealing, of course, you know, on a worldwide level. And you know, folks, that no matter what you do in life, you know how you just keep pushing it and pushing it. And you bring up a great point about how in 73, you figure that, you know, they did it because they don't want people to understand that, you know, that they really don't want them to do it. I love that defensive thinking, man. I'm not kidding.
Well, you know, these people are masters.
Yes.
Of financial psychology and political psychology, or they wouldn't be where they are.
Right.
Well, you have to give them a certain amount of credit that they
absolutely
know the game.
Yes, that's for sure.
And they know how
game
to play this.
It's their game.
That's right. It's their game. As long as the rubes, if you will, right?
Yes.
Are willing to accept the rules as given to them and the so-called facts, the data, as given to them by the money management people, we're always going to get this result until, of course, they bust the bank.
Right.
Right. And until the system has one of its major meltdowns. And even then, see, this is the interesting thing in my mind, even then I would tend to doubt now that people will understand why it happened.
I agree. And they'll change the rules again.
That's right.
Right.
And that's one of the things your listeners have to keep in mind in terms of, you know, their planning. I don't give investment
yes
planning, but this is one important point. When crises of these types occur, look back in history and see what the ruling group has done. It has always changed the rules in its own interest.
Yes.
All right? That's the important thing. And one has to keep that in mind. Assuming that some kind of crisis, you can predict whatever kind of crisis you like, occurs, what will they do to maintain their own positions of power and wealth.
Yeah.
And then you try to extrapolate from the past, say, well, this is how they're going to manipulate the system. I doubt, really, that many people would have believed in 1932 that Roosevelt was going to come in and seize the gold, all right?
Yes.
But if you would look back into the 19th century and seen all of these bank failures where the state governments, for instance, had come in and said, okay, banks don't have to pay out gold, what they call suspension of specie payments.
Right.
Those never went on forever. It was a year or so, 8 months, a year and a quarter, whatever, and then the banks that hadn't gone completely bust would come back and they would get back into business. But there was an example of essentially a kind of gold seizure. The states were allowing the banks to hold on to the gold that those banks had in their reserves when that gold should have been paid to the customers, to the note holders, right?
Right.
When we get to 1933, of course, we're not dealing simply with state banks, we're dealing with a national banking cartel, and one could have extrapolated from that earlier experience that, oh, here's what this guy may do. He may simply say that the Federal Reserve never has to pay out gold anymore.
Right.
Ah, we better be worried about this.
Yep.
We better get some of our assets out of the country. I mean, there are all sorts of options that you could think of at that time.
Well, you know what's amazing is that when I you know, getting into the confiscation in 33, and, you know, we've been into gold now for maybe about two years, heavily, right?
Right.
And I always got asked the question, well, you think they can do it again? And at the very beginning, I was saying, no, there's no way they can do that, right? You know, because I felt like in 33, they were sheep coming up to the bank saying, oh, here's my gold, and, you know, you can just send to Switzerland and get more money. But I can tell you, after the Patriot passed, and I had Rep. Congressman Ron Paul on, and this is important to understand, folks, he told us flat out that no one had read that whole bill, and they got people in fear enough to pass up, you know, probably one of the most important bills that we had in like 2 seconds flat. I'm saying to myself, you know what, this really could happen again. What, you know, they'll make some kind of a fear deal happen, meaning fear, you know, F-E-A-R.
Right.
And it's amazing just watching how this plays out, you know. It's absolutely
right. And you have to remember a couple of things here. In 33 and 34, gold was actually in the banks and passing through the banks.
Yes.
And so people had come to the banks, in essence, because it's not in coinage form.
Right.
It's going to be much more difficult because of that to call it in.
Thank God.
But on the other side, using such things as the Patriot Act,
yep,
they have more powers to do it than they did then.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting to see how that balance will work out.
Boy, it's amazing. Folks, you want something, you want history, and I can tell you, history's a beautiful subject, folks. Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. You want to get your head into it, go to TFNN right now, folks, okay? Edward Vieira, the book is all of $59 for two great books, folks, 1,690 pages. Edward, thanks so much for the education. Really
thanks,
appreciate
Tom.
It. Have a great one. This is Tom O'Brien. This is Edward Vieira. It's Pieces of Eight, folks, okay? You want the history. It is absolutely phenomenal. We have the Dow up 25. Now it's ever down 20. 420, folks. We're getting the education of a lifetime from Dr. Edward Vieira. Pieces of Eight. That's one of the books he's written, and it's just an absolutely fabulous book. It's about the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. If you'd like to check out the book, folks, okay, you can go to our website at tfnn.com. You just go to the contributor page. Edward Vieira's right there. You just hit his website, and it's an absolutely fabulous book. It's all of $59, folks, okay, for two great books, approximately 1,600 pages, and I can tell you, if you want a true education and open up your eyes, it is absolutely fabulous. Edwin, how you doing?
Oh, great, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. So when are your children going back to school? They're going to be going back to school pretty soon, right?
Oh, beginning in September.
September, okay. So, yeah, you see, I should know that. Being up north in September, down here, they're all in school right now. You know, they started school last couple of weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and how's that big dog of yours? is it an English bulldog you have?
No, it's an Argentine Mastiff.
A Mastiff, yeah. One time I was calling his house, folks, and I could hear this dog. It'd be a beautiful dog, right?
Well, she thinks so.
Perfect, man. That's important. You got to start with yourself, you know. You got to start with yourself.
That's right.
There's no doubt about that.
And not many people disagree with a dog that size.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. So I'm sure you probably need that dog because the way that that we're working on the Fed here, I'm sure that in those circles they must say, geez, you know, it's a shame that guy's educating so many people. That's a real bummer for us.
Well, you know, one thing I think about all this time, I've been in this business for a long while, And it's a question of critical mass.
Yes.
You know, for years and years and years, what I have observed is that there seems to be a certain level, maybe a percentage, however you want to calculate it, but a certain level of people that I run across in society, and this is not just here on the East Coast, but I've traveled across the country giving talks for many years. There's a certain level of people who essentially have educated themselves about this subject. They don't get it in schools. They have to go out of their way to get this information and to work through it and to understand it. And those people, of course, don't live forever.
Yes.
When I was younger,
wow,
I knew many of them.
Yes.
Who are now gone. They've gone off to their eternal rewards, as it were.
Right.
And a certain number of younger people are coming up, studying this subject, learning about it. But it's that same general level for every one that dies off, another one comes in. We're not getting 5, 6, 10, 100 coming into knowledge about this subject. That's the real problem. It's a steady state as opposed to an increasing level of education.
That isn't correct. That's a great observation. I know, listen, I know what you're saying here, because you know what's interesting? It seems like that's in life sometimes too. Do you know what I'm saying? That you get to it, you know, folks, just think of how many times you've just got to that certain point. You're trying to push it over the top. You're trying to push it, and then all of a sudden you get a retracement again. Then you're trying to push it again. You know, the fact of the matter is this is something. And folks, this is what each and every one of us get up in the morning for and go to work for. But I think with the bigger issue that Edwin and I are talking about, this is about freedom. I mean, it's truly about freedom. It's truly about the men and women that have built this great country that basically, you know, already went off to war, you know, and died and got wounded, you know, and it's up to each and every one of us to get educated as to, okay, what is the Constitution? What is it all about? What is the monetary powers all about? And, you know, basically get out there and keep this chain going and expand this chain. And the chain we're talking about, folks, is this, is that what Edward has been explaining to us is that, listen, you know, we are a country of laws. Well, these laws are basically not being adhered to. I mean, when you really break it down, I mean, that's the bottom line, right?
That's exactly right.
It's unbelievable.
And that's the problem, fundamentally, that if you, at the top level, at the legal level, level of the legal system, if the powers that be can simply disregard law, it will have effects all the way down the chain in society. It's not something that's going to stop in Washington, D.C. It's not something that's going to stop in the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee or, you know, whatever we're going to focus on.
Right.
It's going to have effects throughout society. And those effects will generally be negative, and they will, it's like, you know, the analogy that comes to mind is dropping the pebble in the stream.
Absolutely.
And outgo the ripples.
Absolutely.
And they become wider and wider and wider as they go, and they affect more and more people. Crises will develop out of these things simply because of the workings of economic and social laws. We're all familiar with that concept.
Yes.
The problem is, when those crises arise, what will be the response of society? And if people don't have an understanding of what has happened, why it's happened, and why you have to conform whatever remedies you develop to the basic laws of our Constitution, things can only get worse. They can never get better. That's fundamentally the problem. And we've seen that happen. I mean, you take a look at the Social Security system. It's kind of a classic example of this. When that was originally proposed, there were basically two schools of thought. There was the school of thought that said, listen, we have to set this thing up on a fiscally sound basis like an insurance annuity.
Yes.
We cannot have a kind of Ponzi scheme out there where the government is taxing with one hand and spending with the other, but the two are not really correlated. The other side of the debate said, oh, yes, we can do that. We're rich enough to be able to do that as a country, and besides, we have a lot of old folks now who have never paid anything into the system we have to take care of. So they adopted that essentially Ponzified system, and they never corrected it. And the problem has become bigger and bigger and bigger, and every, what is it, 5 years, 7 years, they have another Social Security Commission to look into this, and the commission says, oh, there's a crisis. If we don't look forward 10, 15 years from now, we're going to have a calamity. But nobody really stops and says, wait a minute, we have to grasp this thing from the point of the fundamental principles. So is it going to be fiscally sound or not? And then deal with it.
You know what is incredible to me? When I look at the way that, you know, right now, supposedly we're a country of laws, right?
Right.
And, you know, we have the Senate, we have our Congress, and just the unconstitutional deals that happen in the monetary power, in the system, that keeps going on and on. I'm saying to myself, okay, how does this work? Why can it keep going on? You know, and I guess, what's the answer to that?
Well, it's fundamentally that the people of this country don't hold the leadership class to account.
Okay.
I mean, if you're a shareholder in a small corporation,
yes,
and you see the board of directors and the officers constantly making bad decisions, and in some instances, corrupt decisions, what do? You go to the shareholders meeting and you try and remove them, or I suppose you could sell your shares to somebody else, you know, you get out of the system. But basically, you would attempt to reform that system at the top. Now, the difficulty we have in this country, I think, is that most people don't realize that when you have some unconstitutional action entered into by people in public office, those actions are unlawful.
Right.
All right? And basically, we have a couple of statutes at the federal level that says anyone who under color of law deprives an American of his civil rights commits a criminal act. Well, if a person in public office violates the Constitution, he is depriving all Americans of the civil rights to that extent, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
All right? And nobody seems to notice this or to say much about that. You have a very serious problem in terms of the inability, on the one hand, of a public official to be sitting in that position and to be treated with the respect and dignity and so forth that it's supposed to have because of their official status, and on the other hand, they're violating the law systematically. It really, what I like to call it, is gangster government.
Yeah.
You have situations there where people in public office are really essentially operating as gangsters because they give no consideration to their legal requirements.
Yes.
And again, that has consequences. This system was set up by the Founding Fathers. It's an integrated whole. All the parts play together. You read the Constitution and you recognize, let's not call it the brilliance of these people, but certainly their practical political wisdom. They understood that they were making essentially what we would call today a systems approach to government, all right? At every level, the federal level in Washington, D.C., the state level, and then, of course, the local level down below, and all the way down to the individual because, of course, they protected individual rights with specific statements in the Constitution. So all of that system was designed to function coherently, right? It was all put in there for a reason. And if you just take one part of it and throw it away here, another part of it, throw it away there, and you know, 50 years later, you forget this part and so forth and so on, what's going to happen? You are necessarily going to generate all sorts of political, economic, and social dislocations. You have to.
You know,
can't take any complex system and simply disregard parts of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's the problem that we've had in this country going on for quite a long time. Now, we've been very fortunate that the system has a lot of resiliency, it has checks and balances, it's a very rich country. We've been able to absorb a lot of the bad effects. But you know, if you keep on drinking and smoking
yes.
and eating to excess for years and years and years, eventually it catches up to you. Nobody is strong enough to take that over the long term. And the same is true of social systems. No social system or political system is so strong that it can absorb any amount of abuse. It now, has to come to a critical parting of the ways.
Yes. In your experience, you know, since you've been dealing with this, has there been, you know, basically parts of the Constitution that have been taken away and then over the years reinstated, you failed? I mean, you know, I know none of them are supposed to be taken away, but have you seen that? I mean, does it just keep getting chipped away little by little?
Well, it's a yes and no proposition. That is, if you go back historically to the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment was really designed by its authors to require the states to live up to the Bill of Rights. There had been a very early Supreme Court decision that said that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. And the Congress following the Civil War thought that that denial of the application of the Bill of Rights was one of the things that had led to the Civil War.
Okay.
So when they passed the 14th Amendment, Section 1, they put in a clause called the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which was designed by the people who drafted it to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. Well, the Supreme Court came along right shortly after the amendment was enacted, was ratified, and said, oh, no, that Privileges and Immunities Clause doesn't do that, and so essentially they nullified it. Over the years, though, when the Supreme Court was faced with cases in which the states were denying due process to various people, were denying equal protection, were doing other things that were in violation of basic freedoms, the Supreme Court slowly but surely came up with a doctrine which they called the Incorporation Doctrine, which piece by piece put a lot of the Bill of Rights back into the 14th Amendment. It didn't go as far as the authors wanted, but it certainly went closer to their desire than what had happened previously. So one could say, well, that was an advantage, because I don't know how anyone could stand up for the proposition that a state government should be allowed to deny people freedom of speech. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, if we look to those areas that were designed to control the government in terms of taxation, in terms of spending, in terms of the monetary powers, what we see is a general movement towards more and more central government control. And the limitations, especially in the monetary field, which were extremely clear, the limitations that were set out to confine the central government within a narrow area of activity have essentially been swept away, and there's been no movement whatsoever to return to the original concept.
Right. And folks, this is where, I'm telling you, you want to get this book and read it, because this is where the disabilities come in of the United States Constitution. You know, and Edward's explained this to us before, but I can tell you flat out, the disabilities is something that you want to understand, because that is what, not what the Fed's about. And we all know, you know, the bigger government wants to be not only, you know, control us, they want to control the world, it seems like, okay, and they got their own agenda. But that agenda, folks, goes all the way back to what? It goes back to the monetary powers. It goes back to the Fed. It goes back to private ownership. It goes back to one world. And, you know, when we look at this, Edward, you know, it's unbelievable how smart they are and how they've done it. You know what I mean? It's like piece by piece. And, you know, I look at people out there working, and I'm saying to myself, well, you know what's amazing? You know, what came out a couple weeks ago is that all our biggest insurance companies, right? I don't know if you've seen this article, but it was a trip. What they did not to pay taxes is that they set up mutual funds in the Caymans, right? All in the Caribbean. The legal deal, you can set it up, right? But they took their best trades, put it in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And, of course, they it's just amazing. You know, you suck the money out, you put it somewhere else, you push it in, and I guess that's the route we were on, but it's not the route that I'd like to see, that's for sure.
Well, one of the great aspects of the Founding Fathers' insights was they were very aware that power tends to feed on itself. You give someone a little bit of power, and the natural tendency in people is to try to expand it. That's why the Constitution was written the way it was.
Yes.
With grants of power, but disabilities, that is, limitations on power, so that there would be clear lines of demarcation. This is as far as this branch can go. This is as far as this level can go, and no further. And then they also built in checks and balances so that one branch or one level would tend to be jealous or wary, if you will, suspicious of the other. And that's another thing that we've seen breaking down, primarily again through money. In the 1930s, the Roosevelt administration, various Roosevelt administrations, I mean, before, for heaven's sakes, but Roosevelt came up with this idea of using federal money essentially to bribe the states into adopting federal policies and programs that Congress could not legislate directly.
Wow.
Right? And they use the spending power of the national government, essentially say, look, here's a program, and if you want this money,
yes,
you have to follow these guidelines, these regulations. We can't impose those on you directly, but we can make them a condition of the grant of this federal...
Yeah, it's legal bribery, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they still do that today. I mean, that's the reality, right?
That's right. And notice how that worked. First, it expanded the power of the federal government.
Yes.
And on the other side, it limited the suspicion and wariness of the state governments, because, of course, they wanted this money.
They sold their soul.
That's right.
Listen, folks, okay, don't sell your soul. The bottom line is, we get a shot. You want your children to have a great world? You want your grandchildren to have a great world? The United States? Bottom line, folks, okay, check it out. It's monetary powers, and it's the pieces of eight. Edward, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Have a great one. Talk to you next Wednesday. We're going to be right back.
Jim Moore.
And Dr. Edward Vieira, Pieces of Eight. We're getting our education each and every Wednesday at 4:20 on, you know, the not only the banking system and, you know, the monetary powers and disabilities of the United States Constitution. Edwin, how you doing?
Fine, Tom. How's things going?
It's going great. Thank you so much. So I'm sure your children are getting ready to go back to school next week, right?
Oh, I'm getting ready, thank you.
Oh, you are too?
No, I'm getting ready to send them back.
I love it.
Let's be realistic here.
That's even better. That's right. No doubt about it. You know, we've been talking about exactly how we got to this point. And what I was thinking is that, you know, fractional banking, you know, the Federal Reserve, you know, how can we clean this up? How can we, you know, reform American banking systems? I mean,
well, first let's step back one or two paces.
Okay, great.
And see what developed or how it developed.
Okay.
And what you're really looking at here, in this country, historically, government was completely in control of the money supply from the beginning, either because it was being coined in England or in the colonies, they were generating so-called bills of credit. That was the first paper money.
Yes.
And the founding fathers come along and they outlaw paper money because of their own experience with the tremendous inflation of the War of Independence. They saw the great difficulty in having political control of money. So the Constitution sets specific standards. It gives us the dollar, which is the specific silver coin. It gives us gold and silver coin is the only legal tender. And it essentially outlaws politicized paper money, all right?
Yes.
That's the key word, politicized. That is paper money that has a link to the political process.
Right.
It would not stop private banks or institutions of that nature from generating notes or what we would consider to be paper currencies. Credit systems that would be transferred in a monetary form. But it would prevent those kinds of institutions from having any dangerous, incestuous links into the political system and the political power structure.
And then at that particular, this is a great point you're making here, because at that point, if I understand that correctly, that would be up to me and you whether we want to take that money off a private bank. Would
that
be correct?
That's exactly right.
Cool.
The market would control those institutions.
Yes.
If they were serving a market function that is an economically valid function, they would prosper. If not, they would go under, right?
Right.
That would be the control mechanism. And we understand that as soon as you inject political influence into any kind of a market system, then you no longer have that kind of control. Now decisions are being made arbitrarily because they fit somebody's political agenda, not because they serve people in the marketplace. So that was the basic plan. You wanted official money. You have to have some kind of official money because you have to be able to designate what it is the government will take or must take for its own use in taxation and spending, right?
There's
a monetary side to that. So the Constitution specifies that. It says, in principle, because it doesn't say this explicitly, but in principle, everything else is left to the interplay of the free market. Now, of course, we recognize that people in the marketplace, whether they're in the banking industry or any other industry, when they see downsides to their business, they are going to tend to look for escape hatches. One of the classic escape hatches or protective mechanisms has been to turn to the political system.
Right.
Get some kind of political favoritism, political support, subsidy, whatever you want to call
change
it.
The rules,
call corporate
right.
welfare, right?
Sure.
We call that today corporate welfare. That's been a mechanism throughout history. So it's not surprising that very early on in this country we saw the financial institutions working on the political power structure, as it were, both at the national level and at the state level, to create politically favored banks. At the national level, you had the Bank of the United States, which eventually President Andrew Jackson fought and destroyed. At the state level, you had many state banks. These were banks that were chartered and, in many instances, controlled by the legislatures of various states. These things were an attempt to circumvent the limitations of the Constitution. And essentially, they failed. I mean, literally, the two banks in the United States, one was, its charter was not, it ran out, was not renewed. The second one, of course, Jackson fought, and that eventually became a state bank and then went out of business.
Yes.
And you had a whole series of banking failures by these various state banks. Comes the Civil War, this was the crux point, really, in which government became directly involved in the monetary system with the generation of the so-called greenback currency. Why did they do that? Because they were afraid that the Union forces, the Union Congress we're talking about now, was afraid to raise taxes to the level that was necessary to fund the war. It was, to a large degree, an unpopular war.
Okay.
Right? And so they turned, in a kind of panic situation, which my book describes in some detail, they turned to the generation of legal tender paper currency. Now, that was one thing. That's the government getting directly into the generation of paper currency, something that was outlawed by the Constitution. The other, that was 1862. 1863, they took another very fateful step. The Union Congress passed what was called the National Currency Act. And this allowed private banks to be set up that would essentially buy United States bonds in the marketplace, turn them over to the Treasury, and they would receive 90% of the face value of those bonds in currency, so-called national currency. And then they could loan that currency out at interest, while at the same time they were receiving interest payments on these bonds that they had deposited with the Treasury. So this was a mechanism for tying a banking system into the generation of public debt. Because the more public debt you generated, the more currency the banks would have to loan.
So that's right. Almost really the first Fed right there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That was basically that kind of an idea. Now, it failed, or it was perceived to fail, because there was no, as we say today, lender of last resort.
Okay.
It was a kind of pyramid structure in the sense that the banks in the big cities had more power than the banks in the medium-sized cities and what they called the country banks. But there was no umbrella organization or apex to the pyramid, if you will,
that
could bail out the whole system if there were problems. They had a whole series of these problems under the National Currency Act, a whole series of what they used to call panics. We would call them depressions or recessions, serious recessions. And that led to a demand for, or pressure for, demand from the financial community and political pressure for the creation of something like a central bank. Now, the concept of a central bank was really a European concept, and that didn't play too well in this country from a political perspective. People were a little bit afraid of that concept. They thought it would be controlled out of the New York financial centers. And that's why the Federal Reserve System was set up in the way it was, as this kind of decentralized operation with 12 regional banks and then the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. So it was to be perceived as something that was not centralized and controlled by an elite financial community. Now, the reality of the situation is, of course, that the New York Fed is probably the dominant,
runs the whole deal, the dominant one in
the system, right?
Right?
The rest are just kind of window dressing in a sense. But the key to that was now they politicized the national banking system even more, because under the national banking system, you didn't have a structure such as the Board of Governors with Mr. Greenspan at the head of it that could set policy for the whole bloody system.
Okay.
The system was still decentralized. They were private banks all around the country, and all they had to do was conform to certain reserve requirements. I mean, there were some regulations that they had to meet, but there wasn't a centralized apex of the pyramid type controlling unit there. That's what the Federal Reserve System brings into play. And so now you have a complete intermeshing of the political system, the government, and the banking system, plus the currency now, and this happened in 1933, 1934, the currency of this banking cartel is now made legal tender.
Yes.
All right? That wasn't true of the national currency under the 1863 Act. All right, those banks could generate the currency, but it was not legal tender. The only legal tender was the money the government generated.
And that was in 1933 that the next act made it legal
tender. That's right. That's when, when the Federal Reserve System was originally passed, Federal Reserve Acts were not legal tender. They were redeemable in gold, but they were not legal tender. The only legal tender was the governmentally generated money.
Wow.
So we come into the 30s, and there is the key to the legal tender aspect, plus the first fatal, really fatal step. Because remember, the tie-in from the time of the Founding Fathers of money to the economy was that it was based upon specie, gold and silver, right?
Yes.
Gold and silver requires capital and labor to be mined, refined, minted, and so forth and so on. So there's an economic tie-in between the quantity of money and the desires of the market, the needs of the market for increase of the money supply. Whereas when you have politicized money that can be generated out of a printing press or can be generated electronically, well, of course, there's no necessary market tie-in. Right? Doesn't cost anything to generate.
Exactly. It comes out of thin air.
It comes out of thin air. So that ultimately gives a completely arbitrary cast to the money supply. The money supply is not something that's tied into the needs of the market. And all of a sudden we begin injecting throughout the market system this essentially non-rational component, politically determined supply of money. And whatever the consequences are out there, they certainly will not be consequences that the market has foreseen. There'll
right.
be consequences that follow from whatever the political agenda of the leading group is.
Of that time, right?
Of that time, that's right.
Yep.
Now, in 1933, not only did they give Federal Reserve notes the character of legal tender, which is a big jump, But they stopped the redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold. And so we start moving away, the currency system starts moving away from any connection to gold and silver. You come to 1967, 1968, they removed the silver backing to the silver, what were called the silver certificates.
Yes.
The governmentally generated paper currency silver certificates. So now there is no specie backing to the system. There's no anchor, as it were, in reality. The thing is entirely politicized. And of course they tell us, well, you know, the ultimate backing for the currency is the wealth of the United States. Well, that's an interesting circle, because the wealth of the United States is measured in the money, and yet the money, the value of the money is going to be measured in the wealth of the United States. You know, which is the dog and which is the tail and which is the dog?
And at this point, if you actually looked at it, we're in debt. so it's like, okay, if that was your household, you'd be in debt and you wouldn't have any money.
You would have declared bankruptcy long
right.
ago. So there's the system. Now we've come down to this essentially self-contradiction. Because, you know, money is supposed to be the most liquid asset in society. That's the definition.
Yes.
Well, how can debt be that?
Exactly. This
right?
is,
debt
this
requires
is crucial,
collection.
Folks. This is crucial, absolutely.
All right? Debt requires collection. If you have a debt, that debt is not liquid until it has been, as they say, reified.
Yes.
Until I've come and been able to collect it. Because I may find that a debtor can only pay me 1 cent on the dollar.
Right.
Right? So if debt is the basis of your monetary system, you're really working with something that, by definition, denies its monetary character if the definition of money is the most liquid asset in society. So you see, this whole thing is fascinating, because not only is a legal proposition, is it non-rational, does it not make sense, but as an economic proposition, it doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
And yet, here's this whole pyramid that's being built on that kind of a foundation.
The amazing thing is that, you know, I can really understand, you know, you get thousands of Ponzi schemes out there, and they arrest people for them, and the reality is that this is one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in the world. And so it's like, this is unbelievable looking at it.
It goes to show you that governments get away with essentially anything.
Absolutely.
Right? And they'll blame you for doing something on a smaller scale.
Right.
Well, they don't like competition and thievery.
Yes.
I suppose that's the...
Oh, listen, that's it? Edwin, that's it? Listen, folks, you know... I know this is hard to comprehend, but the reality is that money is debt, and there's nothing behind it. And, you know, we're going forward, but the fact of the matter is this thing somewhere, somehow is going to, you know, not end like each one of us would like it to end.
That's right. The money system is essentially based on circulating debt. And circulating debt, its value depends upon confidence, right?
Yes.
The creditor has to have confidence in the debtor. If I hold an ounce of gold in my hand, I don't have to have confidence in anybody.
Right.
I have this asset, which because of its chemical nature, has shown historically value in society. People want this kind of thing.
Right.
I don't have to depend upon someone delivering me an asset of value. I have an asset of value.
And there's only so much you can get out of the ground.
That's right. There's only so much of it. All right. So it's going to maintain that value within a narrow range. If somebody hands me even something like a treasury note, a treasury bond, what am I depending on? Well, I'm depending on the solvency of this huge institution out there, or if I'm talking about somebody else's debt, the solvency of perhaps an individual out there.
Yes.
And that's a problematical matter.
It certainly is.
That depends upon all sorts of contingencies over which I have no control whatsoever. Now, this government that we have today happens to be maintaining a pretty high credit rating, all right? A lot of people want to buy U.S. Treasury debt.
Yes.
All one has to do is to think back to the 1930s. We had a monetary catastrophe in this country. 1971, the country declared bankruptcy, in essence, when President Nixon closed the gold window
right.
for redemption internationally of Federal Reserve notes. So we've had experiences just in the last century which would cause you to question the necessary ability even of the United States government to pay its debts in 100 cents on the dollar. And I mean 100 cents worth of the same purchasing power.
Right.
They always pay their debts in 100 cents on the dollar, if you know what I mean. But the purchasing power of those 100 cents that you receive may be sufficiently low so that you're really losing almost the entire debt. That's the history in the long run of what happens to governments that go into over-indebtedness.
And you can see it here, folks. Okay, I mean, you know, Edward's on there, like, gold is up 7:30 today, right? And this is one of the first days. It's a major breakout. And, you know, the equities, they all blew them away with volume. And what was intriguing about it, though, is that the dollar wasn't really down. So it's almost, you know, what it's saying to me, you know, is that even right across the world, it's not only just happening here, it's happening all across the world, that they're saying, hey, listen, you know, you're inflating this thing and they're just starting. And I mean, the Fed is telling us flat out, hey, we're going to print money. And as Ed was explaining here, folks, the 30-year bonds, the person that makes out the most in an inflated society is he or she who owes the most. And right now, it's our government that owes the most. So it's in their interest to inflate everything. You know, you pay back 10 cents on the dollar 30 years from now.
That's right. It's in their interest on that side of the coin, and it's in their interest also because they don't want to raise taxes to the level that they undermine production in this country. Think of that other side, right?
Right.
Two ways to finance government. You can finance it by borrowing.
Okay.
You can finance it by taxation. You don't want to raise taxes too high, because the higher you raise taxes, the more pressure you put on the productive system. You drive it down, 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 and eventually reach the level that very high taxes get very little revenue, because no one's producing.
Yes.
On the indebtedness side, if you're borrowing out of the marketplace directly, then you're taking away money that would be going into the capital markets, we assume, would be going into the capital markets. So you're also putting a downward pressure on production. So your third course is to generate paper money, right, or electronic money.
Right.
To borrow indirectly through the Federal Reserve, let the Federal Reserve generate new money that you can spend immediately. That's not a matter of direct taxation, so it doesn't have the bad effect there. It's not a matter of direct borrowing out of the economy, so it doesn't have the bad effect there. And the long-term effect of inflation, you blame on somebody else. You blame on the Arab oil producers. You blame on labor unions. You blame on anybody.
Exactly.
Except the politicians.
Right.
Because 99 out of 100 people or 999 out of 1,000 people have no idea how the monetary system works and what it does to them.
They're getting their pockets picked without realizing.
That's right.
Right. You know, it's wild is that you can, and what happens here, folks, is that you can think you have 100 grand, 200 grand to the bank, whatever it is, 10 grand, 5 grand, and all of a sudden you think that's going to be all right for retirement. Well, all of a sudden, you know, whether it's 10 or 20 years from now, well, that 100 grand, you know, is not going to buy what, you know, basically, you know, 50 grand bought today.
And that's why I always tell people, look, go and read about what happened in Argentina.
Yes.
In the last 30 years, we're not talking about 200 years ago, right? We're talking about 1980 and then most recently, the last couple of years. Go back a little before that. Argentina, again, was a very rich and sophisticated country. It went through a whole series of these monetary catastrophes. Go back and look at what happened to Germany in the 1920s. Again, a highly sophisticated country. Had a complete blowout of their monetary system. This is not something that happens just to minor countries far, far away. It happens to some of the most sophisticated and intelligent people in the world because the political pressure that develops through what government overspending, the politicization of the economy, the political pressure that develops in the direction of using the monetary system to solve these political problems becomes overwhelming. The politicians would much rather do that than turn to taxation or excessive borrowing, because the effects of those two are felt immediately and people know whom to blame. Right? Taxes go up, you blame your congressman, right?
Absolutely.
Inflation goes up, oh, well, maybe that was Greenspan. Then Greenspan, of course, come in the air and say, well, he had nothing to do with it. It was this, that, and the other. That's no explanation nobody understands, right?
And then, you know, the fact is that most of those politicians are gone by the time the hurting comes on the public.
That's exactly right. Après moi le déluge, I'll let them eat cake, is the old expression.
Oh,
I've gotten
that.
Mine, I've been elected, I'm gone with my pension.
Say that again, let me hear that pension. Latin again. Let me hear that.
Hmm?
Let me hear that Latin again. That's Latin.
Well,
what is it?
It's actually French. Après moi le déluge.
Oh, I like
After
that.
After me the flood.
Yeah, right.
Right. Once
right.
I'm gone, let anything happen.
Yep, absolutely.
Right. And that's very, very typical. That's one of the problems with the whole political system, is that somebody can pass a law today that seems to benefit people today, because the people who will be harmed are not going to show up.
Right.
For another 10 or 15 years. Right.
Right.
You're passing on the burden of these benefits, the benefits and the burdens in the political system, especially through the use of monetary manipulation, are separated in time, and they're separated in terms of the persons that either enjoy them or suffer from them. And that's the viciousness of it. Knowing that that's the way the system works, this is the last kind of system that any rational person would allow to happen, so that you can, how shall I put this, you can afford to indulge yourself today and let future generations suffer.
Right.
I mean, think of the irresponsibility.
Oh, it's sick. It's absolutely sick.
That's right. And yet, that's what we have. And people will tell you, Oh, well, that's wonderful, because, you see, we really owe it to ourselves. We can afford to spend all this. We owe it to ourselves without thinking, wait a minute, the ourselves are two different people. There's the people today who are benefiting from the immediate effects of inflation, and the other part of the ourselves is those people 25 years from now who are going to be suffering when the chickens come home to Capistrano.
Right.
All right, that's the problem, and that raises a tremendous moral question. Not only the constitutional question, right? Not only the legal question or the economic question, but the moral question: does somebody have a right to misuse this system in order to benefit today and then impose perhaps catastrophic burdens? We have.
It's a huge moral question.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that's incredible here, folks, okay, is that, you know, as we're getting educated, you have to take a moral responsibility. I mean, these, you know, even whether you even don't have children, you have friends, you know, I mean, when you look at life in general, okay, I mean, no one has the right, you know, flat out to put someone, you know, down under. And I mean, that's what's happening out here.
Right, and you look at how many people are concerned, and rightly so, about environmental questions.
Absolutely.
Right? They say, we can't do things today that will leave our country, or the whole planet for that matter, in an environmentally worse state than we found it. That's totally irresponsible. It seems as if everybody agrees to that in principle, and the only debate is, well, how much, right?
Right.
How much do we want to do? But everyone agrees to that in principle. When it comes to the monetary system, what's the difference?
There is no difference. And you know, it's interesting, even environmentally, what people don't really understand is that when you destroy that environment, you're actually destroying yourself financially, because the fact of the matter is that everything you live and breathe with, you know, I mean, that's the real bottom line, that you know, and to get it for paper money is absolutely sick.
Well, that's right, and the interesting thing, the analogy is very good, because to a great extent, the monetary system is the basic environment on which the whole market functions.
Right.
All right, that's
right.
The foundation, that's the blood, if you will, that's the nervous system, because it's the monetary system that transmits through the price structure all of the data that the market operates on. And without that data, and without that data being correct data, right, not politically manipulated data, but correct, economically correct data, the market function is not going to operate.
Right.
That's what we're really facing. People go, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, the government, the banks can do this, that, and the other thing that helps them. I say, wait a minute. It's like injecting heroin into the system, to your bloodstream. Yes, for a little while you're going to feel fine. But then, right, there are these bad consequences, and ultimately, as we've seen historically, every society that goes down the road of inflationism, that is, inflation as a political policy, is, in a sense, operating akin to a drug junkie. They've got to have continuous doses and increasing doses of the narcotic, the inflation, in order to keep the society functioning at the same level or progressive level of production. And eventually that leads, as it has throughout history, to a breakdown of the monetary system in the same way that taking heroin leads eventually to the breakdown of the physical system.
Absolutely. And folks, you know what's incredible here, as Edwin is setting this up? The Fed, their policy right now is an inflation rate of 2.3%. Now, what that means, if we take it, that means, okay, we take heroin to 2.3% a year, okay, and, you know, in so many years, you know, where are you in life, okay? Well, in the monetary system, they're saying, hey, that's the rate that we want to shoot for. And what that means, if you take, what, 2 times 20 is 40. So that's saying every 20 years, folks, your money's cut in half. I mean, they're telling you that. They don't put it in those terms, but that's their policy. That's the reality.
That's right. That's just the big picture. Down below that, you have to recognize that while all this inflation is taking place, false signals are being sent through the economy all over the place in terms of how much real wealth is here, there, invested
yeah.
in this, invested in that. And all of those false signals have their own bad consequences. So not only is the money losing 50% of its actual present purchasing power in the course of that period of time, but we have all of these other elements going on for which we can't even quantify what's happening.
Exactly. So, you know, where can we start in the banking system? Well, I guess in the political system, because essentially they've politicized the deal. Where can we start and have the listeners start to say, okay, you know, I mean, I think you've got us a great start, that's for sure, just getting us educated. But what's the next? I mean, what can we do here?
Well, one of the things I think that people can do is to go to, if they're into contacting representatives and senators,
yes.
U.S. representatives and senators, start asking this question about the stability of the monetary system.
Yes.
I mean, you give them the facts and you give them the figures. Ask a congressman. Here's what's happening. At the rate of inflation, even at the rate of inflation of 2.5% or whatever it is exactly,
right.
In 20-some years, 50% of the purchasing power of our money is going to be lost. Are you in favor of this?
No,
and
that's
why?
A great question. Oh, I'm gonna. You know what? I can't wait. I get Phil Graham on tomorrow. I'm gonna ask him that tomorrow. That's great.
Right.
That's a great
question. And what is
the
justification for this?
Right.
If he says, "Oh yes, I'm in favor," what is the justification? And if he says, "No, I'm not in favor," what are you gonna do about it?
Right. Cool, man. Okay.
I would love to have all of them in a room and just go one at, you know, like,
well,
like school
listen,
children.
I gotta
go one
you,
after
I,
the other, ask him that question.
I need some questions because what's going on? Of course, you know. We have the station up in New Hampshire. The presidential candidates are up there.
Right.
Well, you know, I've already had on Lieberman. I've had on Edwards. But I'm going to have each one of them on, and I'd love to get into this with them because this is the one shot, of course, up in New Hampshire. You know, they want to be on. You know what I'm saying?
So, and you know what they'll say? Because the response to some of these people, well, wait a minute. You're asking the wrong man. You want to talk to Alan Greenspan. You want to talk to the Federal Reserve Chairman. They're in charge of the money system.
Right.
And you come back and say, no. Congress is in charge of the money system. Don't you know the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5?
This is going to be great, Edward.
This is you, Mr. Lieberman, whomever you have, and don't
right.
Lieberman, pick a.
Right.
You are the man in charge, and I don't care whether you delegate authority to Greenspan, which of course is unconstitutional, but I don't care whether you delegate. If you have an agent, the principal is always in charge of the agent.
Right.
The principal can never claim that the agent is the one in charge. You can't just slough off that responsibility to some third party over there.
Absolutely.
And if you don't have an answer to that, then what are you doing in Congress?
And what are you doing running for president? Forget
please,
it.
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's
exactly.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. This is going to be good. This is going to be unreal. Listen, Edward, we really appreciate the update each and every Wednesday. And, you know, bottom line, folks, okay, is that it's up to us. I mean, you know, this book, folks, okay, Pieces of Eight, I can tell you flat out, it's two volumes, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. If you go to our website at tfnn.com, you go to the contributor page, you're going to see our man just hit the link right there. It's only $59 for two of these two great volumes, 1,600 pages. And Edward, you know what's really great here, too, is that this is, you know, you right where you are on TFN, and, of course, you're right next to Peter Bernstein, another tiger, right?
All right.
And did you get to see Bernstein's article and then Money Investment in Wall Street Journal today? If you didn't, check it out, right?
I will.
It is so cool. It's unbelievable. And, folks, check it out because he's on the – wait to hear what he said. This is unbelievable. Bernstein's shocking words, market timing. It's a beautiful thing. And Peter, folks, is 85 years old. You know, he's a well-respected money manager out there. And he sat down with these endowments and told them flat out, hey, listen, you know, things have changed. He put these people in shock. You'll crack up when you read the article. And, of course – you know, he, you know, basically wrote, the power of gold and against the gods. And when I was talking to him and his wife live in Vermont now, and, he says, you know, the wealth is going south. The last time I had him on, he was saying, listen, you have to get true wealth because they're going to take your money. And as, you know, as you told us in, he was talking about also, that Greenspan is the one that said, hey, listen, you know, as soon as gold goes, you know that inflation is going, and that's how they're going to take, you know, not only your wealth, they're going to take your freedom.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, and
because as soon as they get a rationalization in an economic crisis, they turn around and leverage that into more political power.
Yeah, exactly.
That is the history. You go on regime after regime, not just this country, not just England. I mean, you can go down almost every country, every country that has gone through this kind of a cycle from the time of the Roman Empire has leveraged economic crisis, usually caused by some government blunder, into more power for the political class.
Yeah.
Until they finally destroy the society and the whole thing collapsed.
Yeah, they were, you know, and they're doing a good job of putting the fear of God in the citizens right now. And that's what you do. You put the fear of God in them, then all of a sudden they're living in fear instead of living in love, and, you know, people get scared.
Yeah,
and
people who are afraid are willing to accept all sorts of limitations on their freedom if they think that will keep them alive or financially secure or whatever their fear may be.
Yes.
And yeah. That's the frightening thing, because constitutional government and liberty depends upon people having exactly the opposite attitude. That the most important thing is not security. All right? the best security you can have is in a prison, right? You're going to be fed every day. You're going to be have a room. You're going to have shelter. Somebody's going to be looking after you.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
That's not the idea of the founding fathers of this country. That's not the idea of a constitutional government where people rule themselves.
That's right.
That's exactly
right.
The opposite.
And you know what's a shame is that people have really lost the concept that we are the government and the government works for us. It absolutely blows my mind. I actually had a friend, you know, I was walking into a, you know, it was a government agency, and, you know, the people are saying that, well, you know, no, you have to do that. And I was looking around saying to myself, hold it, I don't have to do anything. You work for me. You know, what happened to that whole concept? It's my tax money that's paying you. You know, it's like if someone was ever walking in here and said, hey, Tom, this, of course I say, you know, yeah, what can I do for you? Do you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And that attitude has flipped around dramatically in the last 20 years. You know, I mean, I remember when I was a child that I think, you know, there's plenty of great civil servants, but there's plenty of that just think that, hey, listen, you know, you're the public, we're on one side, and we want to get bigger, and we want your tax money, and that's the way we do get bigger.
Well, the attitude is completely reversed from what it should be.
Absolutely.
People in government, so-called public servants, should recognize that they have a tremendous responsibility in those jobs.
Right.
They are there for the purpose of enforcing and applying the law, and the law is the thing controlling them for the benefit of whom? The people who are ultimately the law.
Right.
We the people. Read how the Constitution starts.
Exactly.
It doesn't say we the legislators, or we the judges, or we the President of the United States and the Cabinet. It says we the people do the following.
That's right.
All right? That's the basis of the entire system, is that the ultimate sovereignty, is the word used to be used, the ultimate sovereignty is in the people as a whole. And they are the principals, and these folks in the public offices are the agents. And once again, we come back to that interesting question. Who is in control in the principal-agent relationship? Is it the principal, or is it the agent?
Same deal, right.
Right?
Unbelievable.
We keep coming back to that, and what we have seen more and more, you especially see this now that we have all this Homeland Security question with these various police or agencies or quasi-police agencies.
Absolutely.
Is the attitude of, oh, we're in charge, and you do what we tell you to do.
That's right.
Or else.
And ask me, we know better. Oh, yeah. We know better. Oh, yeah, they know better, all right. Lock them up, throw away the key first, and then ask them, okay,
that's right.
You know, what are we talking about? It's unbelievable. Listen, folks, it's Pieces of Eight. It's Edward Vieira. It's the Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. Go to TFNN. Go to the contributor page. You go right down to Edward Vieira and click that baby and order that book up right now. Edward, thank you so much. You have
thanks,
a great weekend. Have a safe weekend.
Week.
Okay, absolutely. 4:20 each and every Wednesday, folks. This is Tom O'Brien. This is Tiger Financial News Network. We have the